Whether you're shopping at a high-end New York food shop or at an open-air market in Madagascar, food prices are on the rise, and its effects are already beginning to have political implications. According to Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, we're entering the era of food wars. His article, The New Geopolitics of Food, appears in the May issue of Foreign Policy magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Is there one main driver for the increase in global food prices?
It's a convergence of trends, which is why it's probably going to be with us for some time. On the demand side, we have 80 million more people a year. We have maybe 3 billion people moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. And we have, especially in the United States, a literally massive diversion of grain to the production of fuel for cars. Last year, we harvested 400 million tons of grain. 126 million tons went to ethanol distilleries to produce fuel.
Earlier this year, a group of 48 agriculture ministers meeting in Berlin issued a statement which pointed to speculation on food prices. Do you think there's a chance that a good part of these increases are just a result of market manipulation?
Not really. Whenever you're in a scarcity situation, there is an opportunity for speculation, and there are speculators out there, no question about it. But having said that, the real problems are basic ones. I talked about the demand side of the equation. On the supply side, we have climate change. We have spreading water shortages. We have soil erosion, huge dust bowls forming, one in northern China, another in Central Africa. And then the fourth one, in some countries, more agriculturally advanced countries like Japan, France, Germany, the UK, rice and wheat yields are now flattening out because, in effect, farmers have caught up with scientists and there are no new technologies available or remaining that they can use to raise the productivity of their land. So it's a whole series of trends coming together on the demand and the supply side that are leading to a tight food situation.
Has the political upheaval, turmoil in the Middle East had an impact?
It's not had much impact at this point on either the demand or the supply side. What is affecting harvests in the Arab Middle East is water shortages. In Saudi Arabia, that was self-sufficient in wheat production for more than 20 years. Because they were pumping from an aquifer about a half mile down, but they have now largely depleted that aquifer, and their wheat production is in free fall. They'll be out of the wheat production business entirely in another year or two.
They're going
from self-sufficiency to total dependence on imports in just a matter of 3, 4, 5 years.
Hasn't something similar happened in the American Southwest in places like New Mexico?
In the big farm states in the U.S., the two that stand out that have lost irrigated area are California and Texas. And in California, they've lost at least 1 million acres of irrigated land. Texas may have lost even more than that. So we, too, are faced with the loss of irrigation water, but only about a fifth of our wheat crop is produced. A fifth of our grain crop is produced on irrigated land, whereas in India it's 3/5, and in China it's 4/5. So the overpumping in those countries is going to have a far greater impact when aquifers are depleted than it will here.
How quickly can an aquifer be recharged, or can they?
It depends. One in Saudi Arabia happens to be a so-called fossil aquifer. This is water that was put down eons ago. So once it's gone, it's gone. It's like oil. Once it's gone, there's nothing left. Most of the aquifers in India China and the United States are rechargeable aquifers, except for the Ogallala Aquifer in the Great Plains of the United States. It stretches from Nebraska down through the Texas Panhandle. That is essentially a fossil aquifer. So when it's gone, farming there, irrigated farming, will go back to dry land farming.
Saudi Arabia is a wealthy country, probably can afford to buy grain even at high prices. But what about some of the other countries in the region like Yemen?
Yemen's in trouble on the food front. They're overpumping throughout the country, even in the cities now. Some days people don't get any water at all. There's just not enough water left anymore to really satisfy their needs. The other interesting country is Egypt. Egypt either imports its grain or imports the water to produce its grain via the Nile River. I mean, basically, it doesn't rain in Egypt, and so they either have to import their grain or the water to produce the grain. The problem with them, depending on the Nile, is that a lot of the land grabs that have been occurring in recent years have been occurring in Sudan and Ethiopia, which occupy much of the upper Nile watershed. And those land grabs are also water grabs. And so there will be less as they are developed. And these are countries like China and Korea and Saudi Arabia, India. As those land resources are developed, they will be tapping the water in the Nile water system that normally would go to Egypt. So Egypt is going to be squeezed on the waterfront in a way that's probably going to lead to a future tightening of food supplies there.
In some cases, aren't these deals, these land grabs, being struck in countries that already receive food aid, like Ethiopia?
That's the ironic thing, that the governments of Ethiopia and Sudan are selling land to foreign investors, either governments or agribusiness companies, at a time when both countries have several million people dependent on food lifelines from the UN's World Food Program. So this is the sort of irony, and it probably says something about the quality of leadership in government that the national governments would be selling land to other countries at a time when so many of their own people are hungry.
Well, the usual response when we have these kinds of things is for governments to subsidize the cost of grain or to put up high tariffs. Will that work in this current situation?
Well, the high tariffs won't work because they need to import grain as cheaply as possible. The country that is sort of notorious for its bread subsidies is Egypt, and the government spends about $2 billion a year subsidizing cheap bread that most of the population relies on. And so Egypt today is one of the world's leading bread consumers, but to make the bread affordable to the low-income parts of the population, the government has to subsidize. And as wheat prices go up, either the government has to let food prices go up, which is politically risky, or they have to spend ever more on the subsidies to keep food prices under control.
And grain production in Jordan and Iraq is also on the decline. So do you think we've entered an age of peak wheat?
Well, wheat production and indeed overall grain production in the Arab Middle East has peaked and begun to decline, and that includes Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, and in fact it's declining in almost all those countries. But it's the first sort of region in the world where grain production has peaked and begun to decline because of spreading water shortages.
Now, haven't we been having this discussion about running out of food since the time of Malthus? Is there something different here? Has Malthus talked about overpopulation, and it sounds to me like that's a problem here as well with the current population projections at a time when we're unable to even feed the people we have in our countries now.
Well, Malthus was writing just over two centuries ago. I think it was 1798. He wrote that famous treatise on food and population. If he were writing today, he would probably write about not just population of food, but population of water, population of land, a whole bunch of population and energy, a whole bunch of resources. But the number of people in the world today who are chronically hungry and malnourished is over a billion, and that is greater than the population of the world when Malthus wrote his piece over two centuries ago. What we're looking at now is a shift that's occurred in the last decade or so, because during the closing decades of the last century, the number of hungry people in the world was getting smaller year by year. And then as we turn into this century, it began rising again. It bottomed out at maybe 825 million. It's now gone up to over a billion and is climbing. And there's nothing in sight to arrest that rise in the number of hungry people. And to me, it's a disturbing situation, because this is one of the indicators that led to the eventual decline of the Sumerian civilization, for example, or the Mayan civilization, which was the most advanced civilization in the Western hemisphere. In both cases, it was food shortages and spreading hunger and malnutrition that eventually led to their decline.
Although the Mayans knew a lot about irrigation, they just simply had problems with water supply. We're seeing massive dust blows in western China. I guess that's because of mismanagement of the soil. And then there's climate change, which is exacerbating the whole situation. We have very little time, but I wonder, Lester Brown, whether there's anything positive to say about this situation.
Well, there are things we can do if we recognize the seriousness of the problem. There's still a tendency to want to think about this current situation as being temporary. You know, and it'll go away fairly soon. But I don't think that's likely. And we need to launch some major initiatives. For example,
well, we can't even get into them, but people can find some of your thoughts in the article called The New Geopolitics of Food in the May issue of Foreign Policy. My great thanks to Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, Dick Van Dyke talks about his trailblazing sitcom and his many film roles. And then we'll look at the life of Noah Webster, from his creation of the dictionary, which bears his name, to his hobnobbing with the Founding Fathers. Also, Geraldine Brooks talks about her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing, plus Rob Lowe. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. We had help today from Todd McGovern, Jessica Ramey, and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls, and Paul Schneider engineered the Rufus and Martha Wainwright segment. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.